broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman and Kurt Crosby live on your radio. This is the broadcast for December the 1st in the year of our Lord, 2020. This is hour two of two. Our goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, and to promote God, family, and country in the traditions of our founding fathers. Patrick Simmons, righttowork.org with us. Welcome back to Liberty Roundtable Live. Hope you had a delightful Thanksgiving, sir.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, there's so much to talk about. Now, you're an attorney, right?
I'm not, no.
You're not an attorney. Okay. So help me understand your take on this, on the election. Some say it's over, stick a fork in it. Some say Biden won. Some say, oh, no, not so fast. My problem with the whole debate is that the Electoral College hasn't even had their say. They have more sway than even the popular vote. The states haven't all certified. There's lawsuits in the mix. I don't see how anybody in their right mind is calling this election. You might have an opinion that somebody's won, or you might think that the popular votes are overwhelming. You might think all kind of things. But with so many reality checks in place, at least constitutionally speaking, from a law point of view, I don't see how the media in their good faith can even make such speculations at this point.
So you think that the media acts in good faith? I'm sorry. I think you're right. There's a process that the Constitution sets up, the Electoral College, and the states send the electors to do the ultimate vote. And so I think people are jumping the gun. I mean, there's clearly some level of fraud that goes on in every major election. Hopefully, usually it's small enough that it doesn't make a difference in the outcome. But there's a process in place, and there's lawsuits taking place. And, I think that we shouldn't jump to conclusions. We should let that play out, and hopefully the ultimate result is the correct one. But, the rush to declare, this is what happened, and anyone who questions this outcome is, somehow off the reservation is wrong.
And I'm not even picking sides. I'm just telling you that the constitutional reality of how our system works is not complete.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. The Electoral College hasn't done the ultimate, declaration of who is the president-elect.
And the popular votes haven't even all been certified either.
Right, yeah. There's certain states that are still working that system out. There's these lawsuits going on. Some of them may be successful, others probably not. But, there's a certain, and I think the media at large, they want there's an outcome that most of the bigger outlets want, and they decided if they just say it enough, they'll get it, whether that's the correct outcome or not.
Let me tell you what I want. I want transparency. I want the truth. I want honesty in the system. And let the chips fall where they may after those reality checks. Think of that view.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, It should be a simple statement that everyone can get behind, but of course it isn't, that, every legal vote should count and every illegal vote shouldn't count. But that somehow that's become almost controversial. I don't know why.
Amen to that. Now, there's a reason that I'm asking you this. It's not really to pull you into all kinds of controversial stuff that, hey, you don't want to speak on the record about or whatever else, and I understand that. But I'm asking you this for a reason, because when it comes to right to work, when it comes to the Labor Relations Board, when it comes to the president, quote, elect Joe Biden, even though he promised he wouldn't claim that until legitimate victory, until all the I's were dotted and T's were crossed. He promised he wouldn't do that in the debate. He's doing it anyway. But how does this affect as he starts to, quote, build out a cabinet, even though he hasn't won? He's just a candidate at this point. How is this affecting the Labor Relations Board? How is this affecting some of the battles that you're fighting to defend people and their right to work in given states? How is this affecting everything on the ground? That's the reason that I'm kind of backing into it this way, is because I believe that changes are being made really without the legitimate authorization to do so, sir.
Well, I would say, right now, in terms of where the National Right to Work Foundation operates in the federal courts, at the National Labor Relations Board. There haven't obviously been any formal changes because of the election. Certainly, we're very concerned who a President Biden would end up picking. We've heard some names already for the National Labor Relations Board. We've heard some names for the Department of Labor, Bernie Sanders being one of them. And, you know, obviously that it takes it in a very radical direction, one that is very hostile to any workers who are independent, who might not want to be part of a union. So that's a big concern. I think in terms of actually what's happening now on the ground, what we're seeing is some of the union tactics is basically they've tried to slow down all the cases. We've got cases for workers, who are challenging. They want to be able to get the agreement that the union secretly signed with the company about how they're going to help force these workers into a union against their will. The Trump NLRB has been prosecuting that case. It's been moving forward, and suddenly we're seeing delays. We need an extension of time. And I think we're seeing a lot of wait out the clock type of legal tactics. And I'm not saying that those are even like that they're doing anything procedurally that's illegitimate, but it's definitely something we're seeing is that instead of they're going to say, look, all we got to do is wait until the Biden appointees come in, and then we'll have an umpire who's not calling balls and strikes, but who also is, you know, on our payroll. And then at that point, we can, the lawyers for the unions are going to have a favorable outcome, probably not because of the merits of the case, but because of who is judging it.
Let me tell you why I bring this up. On your news feed, there's a bunch of stories that says union officials back down, union officials back down. And at first glance, it looks great. Wow, that's awesome. But when you dig in, there might be another strategy at work, right?
Yeah, well, that's a good thing that we're seeing. I mean, it's not good, but yeah, basically we're seeing this tactic, and I was talking about at the NLRB where you're seeing the cases are slowing down, but also a lot of our cases in federal court to enforce Janus, and this has been written about by some attorneys elsewhere that this is the tactic that goes on everywhere, but especially the unions are employing this in public sector unions. They've got all these restrictions on workers' Janus rights, where you have a First Amendment right to not pay union dues, to cut off your dues anytime. The Supreme Court made it very clear you cannot pay dues unless you have affirmatively said, yes, I understand I have a First Amendment right not to pay, but I want to pay anyway. And yet what we're seeing all across the country for hundreds of thousands, probably millions of public employees, is they run into these policies that unions have created where they say, well, okay, you have a First Amendment right not to pay, but you can only exercise that right, let's 15 days a year or 10 days a year or 15 days once every 3 years. These are all actual examples we've seen. And you file the lawsuit and the union might back down, say, okay, well, we'll let you out, we'll settle it. In some cases, that's meant 30,000 workers are free, and that's a great thing. But what they're strategically doing is avoiding precedents against them on this, which then makes it easier for these restrictions to basically hold. If you want to exercise your First Amendment right now, you have to file a class action lawsuit. Fortunately, the National Right to Work Foundation is there to help workers do that for free, because they certainly couldn't do it if they had to pay out of pocket, to hire a lawyer to save, maybe $700 or $1,000 a year. But you can see where that all adds up when you're talking about 30,000 workers. We're talking about, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars that unions are taking in violation of workers' First Amendment rights. And yet they're constantly doing this, sort of attack and then settle the case to avoid the precedent. And it's one of the tactics we're seeing. I think it's going to accelerate with the fact that now, without the Trump administration or with the new administration likely coming in, you've got you know, probably more friendlier judges. You've got the Department of Labor, the Department of Justice will suddenly be fully in the tank for union officials, even though it means defending the workers' rights being violated, violation of hundreds of thousands of workers, you know, just for unions. But it's a very you know, it's on one hand, it's of course always good to win a case, and when you get everything you ask for in a legal case, that generally ends it. You know, there's a legal doctrine that you have to be fighting over something real. You can't be just setting a precedent, even though one side has already given in. If otherwise, the case becomes moot. But you know, in terms of the bigger picture of the mass violation of workers' First Amendment rights, this tactic of avoiding any precedential decisions is one we're certainly seeing, and it's long run making it more difficult to enforce the First Amendment.
And these cases where they're, you know, feigning backing away so that the cases slow down in the courts, what they're hoping is that new blood comes into the NLRB. They're hoping that a rule change or two or three or another couple of, you know, twists and turns via the government can give them the upper hand. Then they'll press their advantage.
Yeah, without a doubt. They've got all sorts of things they're looking forward to doing with the new NLRB, because they're going to let them get away with a lot of coercive tactics that this NLRB has not been so quick to turn a blind eye to.
All right, hang tight, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Liberty Roundtable Live.
Hi, I'm Patty, wife of former Congressman Steve Stockman. In Congress, Steve sought impeachment of Eric Holder for his corruption of the Justice Department and his fast and furious gun running that caused Border Agent Brian Talley's death. Steve called for arrest of Lois Lerner for her contempt of Congress as it investigated her targeting of conservative nonprofit groups. After 4 years, four grand juries, and millions of tax dollars, Steve Stockman is in prison. His case involved four checks to nonprofits. DOJ has one standard for Hillary Clinton, but another for folks like President Trump and my husband. We've spent all our savings, all Steve's retirement, and much of mine. Steve Stockman has fought for you and America. Won't you join me now to fight for Steve? To help, text FIGHT to 444-999. Text FIGHT to 444-999 or go to defendapatriot.com. Defendapatriot.com.
Recent studies show that parents who smoke in the home are more likely to have children who smoke.
Yes, in fact, my brother, he's 22 now, he told me and my father that's why he started smoking. One of the reasons why he started smoking is because my dad was around, you know, and they saw my dad smoking. My dad said, okay, I don't want you to smoke. I don't want you to, you know, watch what I'm doing.
Recent studies also show that in homes where parents don't smoke, their children usually don't smoke either.
I am the way I am because my grandparents taught me what not to do. They gave me morals. They gave me belief. They gave me something to believe in. They just taught me well. I love them. I do.
Smoking. If you think you're old enough to start, you're smart enough to stop. A public service message from this station and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Promoting God, family, and country. You are listening to Liberty Roundtable Radio.
All right, Patrick Simmons with us, righttowork.org, doing a great job. So, hey, the battle's on for your right to work. How does the broader discussion of the economy play into this, looking in the future? No matter who wins, the economy, they say, is in trouble. I think it's you know, coming back fairly well, but if we contemplate other lockdowns and everything else, who knows? How does that all relate to our right to work and what's happening behind the scenes there, Patrick?
Well, I mean, I guess a couple aspects of that. I mean, one certainly, you know, right to work, obviously the reason we support it, the first and most important reason is the individual liberty it gives and protects for workers. It lets them choose. If they want to join a union, they can. If they don't want to, they can't be required to. If they want to fund a union, pay dues, they can. But if they don't want to, They can't be required to do that either. And it's a private organization. We believe everyone should have that choice. But one of the things that we see time and time again, you look at right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states, job creation in right-to-work states is double the rate of non-right-to-work states. And it's consistent. You can look over decades. It's really a wonderful aspect of right-to-work is this proven track record of job creation. And certainly right now, when you think about a lot of the things that government does, state governments will do to try and create jobs, a lot of them, end up costing. It's a budget item. It's a budget fight. It's a dollar spent on this stimulus that can't be spent on something else. Whether that's a long-term solution to actually job creation is, of course, a bigger question. But that's how a lot of elected officials view it. And yet you've got right to work, which is this thing you can do. It doesn't cost taxpayer money. You're not pulling money from the schools, or from healthcare, or from whatever else state governments are doing, and you're providing freedom for workers, and at the same time, it has this job creating engine that right to work creates, and economists have studied this, but I mean fundamentally, I think the answer to why that happens is that the incentives change for unions. When there's not a right to work law in place, their incentive is get in any means necessary to a workplace, because once you're in, you can force every single worker to pay you money, and they're basically trapped paying money if they want to keep their job. With right to work, even if the union gets in, if a lot of those workers say, "We never wanted you, why are you here? You're a third party in our workplace, we're going to cut off your dues," it basically changes the incentive. So the unions are really in right to work states. They're there when a significant percentage of workers actually want them there, versus they're just there because once they get in, they can collect the dues. So anyway, what I hope to see, and what I think is likely, is that we may even have some new right-to-work states this coming year. Of course, everyone, is focused on the presidential election, but one of the things that's pretty clear is that largely Republicans did very well in state houses across the country. And I think that opens the door to possibly new right-to-work laws, which would be a huge deal. And like I said, it's a way that you can create jobs, which, of course, with the pandemic changing so many things, harming, the economy and businesses. When we were looking for a way to get things going again, to create jobs, create opportunities, a right-to-work law could be a real attractive tool that state legislatures might look at when they're saying, how do we rebuild after all the damage that the pandemic and the government response to it have created? So that's one of the things I'm hopeful for, is at the state level. Obviously, the federal government, the likelihood of a national right to work law would seemly, it doesn't seem particularly likely. President Biden would veto that. We would certainly expect that he supports a law that would wipe out every right-to-work law in the country. But in terms of at the state level, I think there's actually an opportunity to expand worker freedom, maybe add a right-to-work law, maybe add two. It's hard to know. We're still figuring out exactly where we are in every single state, but it's a possibility, and that would be a great thing to go and add a 28th right-to-work state and maybe a 29th and get up that critical mass that's really going to be a tipping point where everyone says how any state without a right-to-work law is getting left behind.
And let's be very clear. The reason that Patrick says it could be, an opportunity here, that all depends on you and me, ladies and gentlemen. There was a lot of Republican wins across the country. And that in itself doesn't necessarily guarantee success. But what it does mean is there's usually a more friendly climate, a more friendly environment towards right to work, towards the ability to be free and to freely make choices. And I bring that up because it's up to you and I, ladies and gentlemen, in your given states. Are you going to make this an issue? Are you going to say, hey, now Republican, that you've been elected, here's what we expect from you. We want you to double down and create transparency on this. We want you to back the government off on this. We want to bring agency and the right to work to the workplace here in our state. We know that it brings jobs to the table. And that, in my opinion, is the entry point here. When you bring this up, you say, look, this isn't a debate whether you like or dislike unions. This is a reality check. Everywhere in the country where there's studies done, where there's right-to-work states, there's greater opportunities for jobs. There's greater employment. There's and so right now, as we work on recovering the economies across the country, that, in my opinion, is the salient point to focus on for sure. But it's up to you and I, as the American people, to really determine that everywhere an elected official goes, that we politely bring this up and say, hey, this is something that we really believe could make a difference for the economy. This is something that will bring jobs to our area, to our state. You know what? Small business flourishes. That's where 50%+ of the employment comes from. You know what? Small business has been struggling due to the pandemic, but there are opportunities here. Let's seize the day. In my opinion, that's the I don't want to say marketing, but that's the point that ought to be pushed on this topic, Patrick.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, you look at the right-to-work laws that have passed recently, you know, you talk about Indiana. That had been a long-term project, a long push, you know, led by the National Right-to-Work Committee and others to grow the support for right-to-work in Indiana. But then you look at some of the other states, Wisconsin and Michigan. These are places that were really hit hard by, you know, the last recession. You know, the 2009, these were places that were struggling. These were places that had a lot of manufacturing and were losing it quickly. And suddenly, obviously, some of the politics were changing there. But also, you know, when they're looking for how do we respond to a changing economy, right to work was a big tool, a big advantage, and one that once places like Indiana passed it, suddenly Michigan and Wisconsin and Kentucky were worried about getting left behind. You know, you pull up the manufacturing job growth over the last decade. In right-to-work states, it's 10%. In forced union states, 2.9%. So, you know, people talk about manufacturing leaving the country, and maybe that's true on net, but they're not leaving right-to-work states. They're actually coming to right-to-work states. It's the forced unionism states that are really the ones hemorrhaging jobs. And so that's why we think, you know, this is a real opportunity for state legislatures, you know, that don't have right to work laws to look around and say, hey, how do we compete in an era where the coronavirus has just done all this damage, there's business shutdowns, and now maybe things are starting to open up. How do we turn on the accelerator on the job creation that we need to dig our way out of this economic you know, problem that we're in? And I think the you know, one of the answers is got to be right to work. And of course, the benefit the other benefit of that, as we've discussed, is all it is about worker freedom. It doesn't stop anyone from joining a union, doesn't stop anyone from paying dues, makes it voluntary.
Nor do we intend them to be forced to stop. We're not even trying to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the, you know, you get into debates with someone over right to work, and ultimately, you know, the thing that no one really can answer, they'll talk around it. You go to them and say, why can't every worker have that choice? Why should they be denied that choice? Why don't you trust workers to decide for themselves whether an individual worker thinks joining a union is in their interest or not? And it's really that simple. It's you know, there are countless lobbying organizations, private associations, you know, churches, all sorts of private organizations that people join. They pay, you know, dues, or they pay, you know, tithing, or however they pay, you know, and it's up to them. It's voluntary, and that's the way it should be in this country.
And all it will do, it won't change the reality if there's unions in a given state. What it will do is it will let people decide if they want to be part of the union based on the merits. And what it will do is it will require the leadership to pay attention to the rank and file. And by agency, by choice, that's what we're after. Patrick, we know you got to fly. We appreciate you, sir. Godspeed. Thank you so much. And you know what? Keep an eye on the ball for us on this, man. This is critical coming up.
It absolutely is. And, happy holidays and New Year, since it might be 2021 before we speak again.
Thank you, sir.
Pursuing liberty, using the Constitution as our guide. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA Radio News with Lance Pride.
Reports are coming in from the Middle East. An Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander was killed by a drone strike along the Syrian-Iraq border on Tuesday. Iran denies the event took place and will continue to look into this. The Supreme Court heard arguments Monday over President Trump's directive to exclude illegal immigrants in the country from the 2020 census count. The census determines the number of House seats each state gets and the allocation of funding to states. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said state officials are investigating third-party groups trying to register people in other states to vote in the Georgia Senate runoffs.
These third-party groups have a responsibility to not encourage illegal voting. If they do so, they will be held responsible.
The investigations are into at least four groups. Efforts come ahead of the January 5th Senate runoffs that will determine control of the U.S. Senate. We are USA Radio News.
Balance of Nature's fruits and vegetables in a capsule, changing the world one life at a time.
The product that you have given me here is, as far as I'm concerned, sent to me from heaven. I love it a great deal. It's hard to find anything that's real nowadays. I enjoy it immensely. It's making my life so much better. I feel so much better. And during this pandemic, I have no worries whatsoever. My immune system has got to be at a top-notch level. I don't seem to get colds or anything. I don't know what getting sick is anymore. This is so cool.
Experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. Right now, Balance of Nature is offering free shipping and 35% off on any new preferred order. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751. Or by going to balanceofnature.com. And make sure to receive this special radio offer by using discount code USA.
Backing President Trump's claim of voter fraud, proof of the voter fraud has been delivered to the FBI. The FBI is using voter fraud information collected by the Amistad Project. The project's director, Philip Klein, said Monday on Newsmax TV.
We've come up with hundreds of thousands of Republicans who say they never requested a ballot, but they voted absentee by somebody else. We've identified people outside of the state who voted within the state, and all of this occurred in the key swing states that we're speaking about. And there's also one other important point to make about all of these areas. Had hundreds of millions of dollars poured into their election offices by Mark Zuckerberg, matching the federal government expenditure. And through his charities, they paid the election judges, they paid the people who boarded up the windows, they bought the machines, and America was kicked out of the counting room and a billionaire invited in all of these swing state urban core cities.
Klein is the former Attorney General of the state of Kansas. USA Radio News.
Begging politicians, bureaucrats, and educrats, and all do-gooders to please obey the supreme law of the land, the Constitution. This is Liberty Roundtable.
All right, back with you live, ladies and gentlemen. More and more evidence coming out about the fraudulent elections, ladies and gentlemen. I find that a good news piece. That's for sure. I guess a pastor in California, Kurt, has now turned his church into a strip club. And it's temporarily done so that he can get around the COVID restrictions. And so here's what he calls it, a family-friendly strip club. And what he does is he gets up in front of the crowd before he's going to speak his sermon or whatever, preach his sermon. And he takes off his coat, Kurt, his suit coat. And so he's just in like a shirt or whatever. And he's just like, hey, I had to, you know, it's kind of hot in here. I got to strip so that we can go ahead and proceed with the work of the Lord. And so it's a family-friendly strip club, and now he can do whatever he wants to, Kurt, because he's, you know, in the right, quote, government-approved category now.
Well, that's right. As far as I understand, this is happening in California, and, you know, the governor says churches can't be open, but strip clubs, you know, that's what you call essential services, I guess, Sam. And so as far as I know, that he went a little farther than that, even ripped off his tie. So as far, you know.
Well, it's getting crazy in there now.
You could, yeah. That's anyway, the new ways of, you know, having to survive in the Chinese virus world we live in. You know,
but it, to me, it highlights, you know, the problems in our society. And I appreciate the pastor there trying to basically say, look, just think how absurd this is, or how, you know, whatever. He's really trying to make a point to get the people to understand what on earth is going on around here? But the pastor is doing a great job, in my opinion, to highlight kind of the problems or whatever. And, you know, it's not really intended to be a strip club at all, ladies and gentlemen. It's intended to highlight the problems we face as religious organizations. How do you get a situation where, you know, strip clubs, bars, whatever, they've got kind of an ability to do things and churches don't? I would hope the Supreme Court would go further and, you know, help out a little bit more and declare a stand for religious freedom. That's the prayer that I would take away from this. Just my take. Any more on that one, Kurt?
No, I think, you know, we should have a lot more of that kind of strip club, Sam. I guess.
If we're going to have strip clubs,
that's
amen.
What it takes.
All right, there you have it. All right, there's a Senate hearing on, what is it, HCQ? Is that hydroxychloroquine or whatever? Treatment nobody
that's
saw.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think this is the way most of these, it's in the, at Promulgant Daily, it's in their on Capitol Hill section. And, you know, the headline, I think it pretty much tells you the story. The Senate hearing on HCQ or hydroxychloroquine treatment nobody saw. Exclusive colon, Joel S. Hirschhorn says Dem lawmakers have no interest in saving American lives.
See, know, Kurt, and this sad, is kind of but, the point that I made the other day. When there's all these different opportunities and treatments out there and all this kind of stuff, why is Fauci still there and Scott Atlas gone? You know, I thought President Trump was going to get rid of Fauci. But this kind of goes to what I'm saying is, why aren't we discussing the real answers to the COVID problem? And this is one
well,
of them,
that's a great
opinion.
Point. And I guess Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican of Wisconsin, he's the chairman of the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. He had a big full committee hearing, and it was about early outpatient treatment, an essential part, they say, in this WorldNet Daily story, of a COVID-19 solution. In the article, it says the leftist press has totally ignored the hearing and the main messages delivered by senators and distinguished doctors who testified. Not extinguished doctors, but distinguished ones. Well, I guess they're kind of extinguished here. But anyway, here are the most critically important things revealed at the hearing. First, there were three of the most acclaimed doctors who have been advocating early home treatment based on using low-cost, safe, generic drugs, principally hydroxychloroquine. The three were Peter McCullough, Harvey Rice, and George Farid. They spoke authoritatively on the success of HCQ or hydroxychloroquine cocktails in keeping COVID patients out of hospital and saving lives. So that kind of makes you think it's one of those British stories where it says out of hospital. We would say out of the hospital, but anyway. And it says they, like I have done in a number of articles, cited specific studies and clinical positive results. Also emphasized by them and Senator Johnson is that the federal government has done nothing to promote early home treatment, and even worse, has done things to block what has been proven to work. I mean, imagine, Sam, if instead of all those commercials you hear from the federal government telling you, you know, you got to roll up your sleeves and take the shot, or you know, get the flu shot, or get you know, your mask on and stay all apart and all that stuff. Imagine if they, you know, suggested there was ways of doing this kind of stuff. But anyway, they say the reason for the malpractice by the government is that the stubborn position of power behind federal agencies. And this goes to your Dr. Fauci thing. It says that's the infamous Dr. Anthony Fauci, who says he believes in science but refuses to accept the incredible amount of clinical findings proving the benefits of various home treatment protocols. But anyway, I'm just looking through to make
sure.
Yeah,
well,
this
Joel Hirschhorn, is that how you say it? I agree with this point completely, except he says Dems in his headline.
Yeah.
And I don't really agree that it's Dems. I mean, I think Democrats are largely responsible, but I think there's a lot of swamp monster Republicans involved, too. In other words, Fauci's there, not Scott Atlas, or not many other, in my opinion, that people who agree with Scott Atlas. For example, this Texas doctor, who I have the most respect for of all, this guy, what's his name? Bartlett is his name.
Richard Bartlett,
in my opinion, Richard Bartlett is a hero. But again, he just gets shut down. But look, it's Republicans that have Atlas there. I mean, Atlas gone, Bartlett shut down, and Fauci taking the, you know, quote, center stage. It's Republicans that have that happening right now.
I'd prefer to just call them the swamp monsters because,
you know, I agree.
This whole, if we could just eliminate, and I've been thinking about kind of the solution to this whole election thing, and I think, imagine if the president said, look, you know, we've been battling this whole Democrat-Republican thing forever, and I found out that George Washington warned us of the spirit of party, and I'm suggesting we go ahead and eliminate parties, and then we basically do a do-over of the, you know, last election where we've got all this, you know, messed up stuff going on, and we go back to make America great again with a pencil and a piece of paper, and, you know, we just kind of do a great reset on the American situation here with the elections and the silly party stuff, and we just be Americans, you know.
For a great reset, but I get your point.
Well, I know, but we could use that term, you know, in this case.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point is I don't want to point the finger at Dems or Republicans. I want to point my finger at the swamp and say, hey, the Senate hearing on HCQ treatment, nobody saw it. Hey, they don't want to save American lives. The swamp doesn't want to save American lives. They don't want to get us back on stable ground. They don't want to get us recovering and on track. Because then they can't have their way with us and make their agenda stick. And I think Joel's right on this whole point, Kurt. All right, who is this? He's Representative-elect Kat Kamik?
Yeah, it's a lady, Sam. And that's her name, Kat. I think it's short for Katrina or Catherine. Anyway, it's a white woman, you know, at least in the picture I saw of her. She's not any, like, you know, model or movie star or anything, but the headline from Breitbart says Representative-elect Kat Kamik, C-A-M-M-A-C-K, colon, only in America could I go from homelessness to Congress. I guess this is in Florida, Sam, where I think they might even have some, you know, honest elections. She said that her election to the House of Representatives after a period of time in which she was homeless illustrates the American dream. She said, just 9 years ago, I was homeless, and only in America can someone go from being homeless to the House of Representatives in less than 9 years. Now she's got a house. It's the House of Representatives, I guess.
That's quite
a cool story. Yeah.
Well, while you got the homeless in Congress now, we've also got a newly elected GOP rep asked to carry a gun on U.S. campus grounds. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
I guess the Capitol grounds is what it is. All right, hang tight. Let's talk about that in seconds.
Can a nation conceived in liberty carry its head high if it denies protection to the youngest and most vulnerable of its citizens? Can a country founded on God-given rights continue to thrive without understanding that life is a precious gift from our Creator? As a physician, I have looked into the eyes of 1-pound babies. I have cradled their small bodies in the palm of one hand. I defy those who are careless, who would disregard life and look at these tiny little miracles and say, we're not going to protect that.
But I believe there will come a time when we are all judged on whether or not we took a stand in defense of all life from the moment of conception until our last natural breath. One thing I promise you, I will always take a stand for life.
as a parent, is receiving a faith-based, character-focused education for your children difficult to find? Do you believe that godly principles should be a central component in your child's education? Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character. For over 40 years, American Heritage School has been educating both hearts and minds, bringing out academic excellence. This is the school where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. With American Heritage School's Advanced Distance Education Program, distance is no longer an issue. With an accredited LDS-oriented curriculum from kindergarten through 12th grade, your children can attend from anywhere in the world. American Heritage School will prepare your child for more than a job. It will prepare them for life. To learn more, visit American-Heritage.org. That's American-Heritage.org.
With news the networks refuse to use. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
I appreciate the newly elected GOP rep asking if she can carry a gun on the Capitol. But you know what, ladies and gentlemen? I want to know why she'd even have to ask. Isn't this the United States of America, for crying out loud? Where you have the right to keep and bear arms, and that right shall not be infringed? This is the lady from Colorado, from what do they call it? Shooter's Grill is what she owns, where all of her staff members are armed and everything else. I think it's in Rifle, Colorado. Anyway, that's so exactly interesting, right. But she's there and she's asking for permission, Kurt.
Well, yeah, I guess she talked to the Capitol Police there about her. Her name is Lauren Boebert, B-O-E-B-E-R-T. She's a newly, anointed one from Colorado there, and asked about from the Capitol Police about her ability to have a gun on Capitol grounds for defense of herself and her fellow lawmakers. She said, "Gun-owning Americans who heard your speech." Talking about Beto O'Rourke, this is when she opposed him back then. But I guess she's checking on it for herself. She now wants her gun with her in D.C. I guess a 1967 law, according to Breitbart here, says congressional members shall not be prohibited from maintaining firearms within the confines of his office or from transporting within Capitol grounds firearms unloaded and securely wrapped. So that's 1967. I bet if they did it now, I'd say his or her or his. Anyway, Representative Massey from Kentucky.
Gender,
oh, that's right. You just have to say it's.
That's correct.
Representative Massey from Kentucky spoke in support of congressional members carrying guns. This is in 20, I guess he recently, he says.
Thomas Massey doing a good job there, by the way.
2017, amen, attacked on a congressional baseball practice and saying as soon as you leave the Capitol property, you are a target. I think you're a target on Capitol property, too, but that's just my opinion. So anyway,
well, there you have it. Anyway, good
Lauren
for her.
Boebert,
we pray she'll be successful.
Turn it up. Yeah, amen.
Time will tell. Ohio customer, Kurt.
Yeah. This headline from Breitbart says, Ohio customer leaves $3,000 tip for a restaurant one day before closing down. Yeah, this is a restaurant in Cleveland, Ohio, and it was a $7 tab. The customer ordered a pint of Stella Artois, I guess A-R-T-O-I-S, beer at Nighttown in Cleveland, Ohio. And left this $3,000 tip. Maybe he had too many drink and whatever.
No, Kurt, anyway, hold on. This guy was an awesome person and had gone to this restaurant for years and knew they were closing and felt like Christmas was coming up. And what a horrible scenario that was for everybody involved. And so this person intentionally left the tip and said, please distribute it among the staff. My years here have been wonderful, and I want to make sure you guys have a Christmas. From what I understand, that's the story, right?
Well, I think so. The restaurant owner, Brendan Ring, gave us a ring, you know, told Breitbart News that the customer handed him the signed check and told him to share the tip amongst the staff. He said, I looked down at the check, but I didn't have my glasses on, and it looked like 300, said Ring, but when I put my glasses on, I realized the tip was for 3,000. I ran out the door after him and said, there's been some mistake. He said, no, I meant it. It was no mistake. I'll see you when you reopen. Anyway, the restaurant owner added that he split the tip. It says the top here, but I'm sure he meant the tip. Among the four wait staff that were working that day, each of them received $750. I walked back in and I had four servers working. I showed it to the first server, and I have a reputation for being a bit of a jokester, so she thought I was kidding. But the next server I showed it to started crying, and that's when the reality set in that it was a real tip. We've all heard these types of good stories before, but I think during the time of COVID, or in parentheses it says Chinese coronavirus, the whole world, you won't see that on NBC or ABC or CBS or anything, the whole world was in the same boat looking for the same good news. I've gotten calls from media companies all over the world. I talked to the whole world today. It's mind-boggling. I don't know if you heard about it anywhere else but here, same.
No, but I'm glad for any of those people. If there really is a group of media coming to his door and telling the tale, I think that's phenomenal. I hope they tell the whole story, though.
Well, it's probably going around the world in places, but not here in America.
Yeah, sad but true. Now, the other thing I want to point out about this story, Kurt, in my opinion, this is an example where, you know what? No good deed will go unnoticed. You know what? Let's do good deeds like this for Christmas. Let's spend time, let's give thanks, let's spend time doing things that brighten up people's days, that give people hope, that give people encouragement, to let people know, you know what, even with the COVID going on and they're trying to destroy our humanity, there's still good people everywhere doing good things. Okay, this guy just went to this place and made friends with the staff over years and just felt like, man, I got to do something for these guys. And see, in my opinion, hey, that guy might not have changed the world by 3 o'clock, right? But he's a hero, man. Okay, we need more people like that. Just think what the world would be like if we had just people everywhere doing this kind of stuff. Anyway, it's tremendous.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Sam.
And it's a great example. And, you know, I don't think the guy was just drunk and did this or whatever. He intentionally, you know, said, hey, I want to help these people. And the owner even went out afterwards and said, hey, was there a mistake? And he's like, oh, no, this is on purpose. You know, please let this take care of those who, you know, have been my friends over the years. And I just think that's a great restaurant. And, I don't know about the alcohol piece. I'm just staying out of that. But it's a great restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got good people serving, doing a good job to where this patron or this guy that went to the restaurant, this customer is really happy over the years. And he's just like, hey, I want to intentionally give back and share the love and the, you know. And this is what America's made of, Kurt.
This guy was asked, by the way, if this was in response to the Ohio governor's, shutting down basically a statewide curfew from 10 o'clock at night. And this guy said, well, the virus doesn't come out at 10 p.m. The curfew is going to prove to be absolutely useless. My decision to close was made based on what's going on. I'm not a big government guy. I'd rather make my own decisions. I'd rather not be told what to do. He added, his restaurant's been around for 30 or 55 years. He says, we can afford to press pause for a minute. A restaurant owner said he hopes to reopen in January, but that'll be contingent on how the Cleveland area is doing with regards to the coronavirus. My hope is to open again sometime then, but when I open, reopen, all depends on the virus, not the government.
Well, my prayers are with him and his family, and I get his point. I understand it.
And the workers.
All right, so Hayward says wildlife officials discovered a, what do they call this thing? Monolith in remote Utah, but then I guess it's now gone, right, Kurt?
Yeah, well, that's right. Do you know what a monolith is?
Nope.
I mean, I was like, another word I got to look up. But, you know, when you look at the picture, it shows this kind of a, it's like you're looking out, you know, say you got some big rock thing in the country, you know, Sam, and you're walking around and you're, you know, there's rock walls or big stones and stuff, and then it looks like somebody took a piece of, you know, steel that's maybe, let's see, this thing is like some helicopter pilot saw this and with the Utah Department of Public Safety, and they went down there and said it was a 10-foot vertical slab of steel. They said it was incongruously parked amid the huge red rocks that fill the area. So, you know, and yet now, doggone it, Sam, it's disappeared.
Yeah, don't worry, they found another one in Europe, though, Kurt. So.
Oh, I didn't get that part. Yeah. You know, must have missed that story, but anyway.
And the value of this story is, Kurt?
Well, it's just kind of like one of those old news of the weird, you know. I mean, who put it there and who got it now? So I don't know, right?
Yeah, it'll be a big conspiracy, man. It'll be harder to find votes that are fraudulent than it will to find this sucker. I'll tell you that right now. Not because they're not there, but because we're not willing to discuss openly and honestly and look in the right places and such, right?
Yeah, good point.
So there you have it. All right, final story, Kurt. This is interesting. You don't need to obey an illegal order.
I like that, don't you, Sam?
Yes, sir.
You know,
that's why I want to make sure to get it in this hour, because I want people to hear this. Yeah.
The headline from Breitbart says, you don't need to obey an illegal order. Tory MP, so this is across the pond, Sam, basically, an MP stands for military police, stands up to cops arresting elderly lockdown protester. This is a member of parliament from the ruling Conservative Party, was seen shouting, you don't need to obey an illegal order. And this was, he was shouting at police as they arrested an elderly woman at a peaceful anti-lockdown protest in London. So, you know, it's... I guess following the arrest, the Tory MP took to the House of Commons to implore Prime Minister Boris Johnson to put an end to the unconstitutional and un-British restrictions on the right to protest. She was an old lady robbed of her dignity for having the courage to protest about having her fundamental rights and those of my constituents and others removed, Sir Charles said.
Yeah, see, I don't like the word protest used here, though. You know what? People have a right to peacefully assemble, Kurt. And with this elderly lady or whatever, it was a peaceful assemblage.
Yeah.
Okay? Because what makes a difference between a peaceful assembly and a protest? And I don't mean to play games with words, but I'm trying to highlight something important. One is saying we believe we've been wronged and we have a redress of grievance solution in our peaceful assembly. We want to get together. We want to discuss it. We want to find solutions and what we can do. We hope that those who we elect who should serve us will appear and listen to us for once. Okay, that's completely different than a protest. What I mean is one blurs into the other. If you're not very careful, then pretty soon what's the difference between a protest and a peaceful riot? Or a riot, you know. And so what I'm saying is that by the words we use, we ratchet up and change the intent, in my mind, of the founders. Now, I know this is in Britain, so it doesn't exactly apply, except for an understanding, right? When does a peaceful assembly become a protest? When does a protest become, well, a violent protest or a peaceful riot? Or what? And what you do is you blur the line of our intentions, okay? And the reason that I bring this up is because we had peaceful assemblies outside of Governor Herbert's house over these mask mandates. And now the governor literally is trying to put laws in place and stuff like that that forces people to be back a certain distance and stuff like that. Pretty soon you're going to ratchet up the crowd to be angry. And then the peaceful protest or the peaceful assembly becomes a peaceful protest, and then pretty soon someone decides to protest a little louder. And if you're not careful, you change the dynamics of what our founders intended. You got to be very careful to prevent that. We also got to be very careful to not let bureaucrats in high places change the game and deny us our ability to freely, peacefully assemble as well. Anyway, just my take on the story, but I like that headline in that article there. Good stuff. Right, hour two in the can, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back tomorrow with hard-hitting news the networks refuse to use. Our prayers are with the president. That is Donald Trump, by the way. And our prayers are with honesty and the truth. Transparency and accountability, we pray will... Well, honesty is the issue. We pray that we're successful in honest elections.